And now, an ad from Dad.
All right, save money on car insurance when you bundle home and auto with Progressive. Can I take these off? All right. What is this? This looks good. Wow. That's well made. Where did you get this? I'm talking to you with the hair. Yeah, where did you get this? It's good stuff. That's solid. That's not veneer. That's solid stuff.
Progressive can't save you from becoming your parents, but we can save you money when you bundle home and auto. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Welcome to Creating a Family. Talk about adoption and infertility. Today we're going to be talking about a topic near and dear to almost every parent I know's heart, sleep issues with adopted kids. A great show, one that you're really going to want to come back to. Here's a sample of what you'll hear.
A lot of people like to think of good sleep, like a good night's sleep, you know, starts with a good day. And the things that you're going to be doing that we've all been talking about sort of during that day to help your child get ready for, I've heard it it explained as sort of like landing a jumbo jet, right? That you're not going to do that abruptly, right? It needs some time, some leading up. So that's why we have these, you know, very predictable, especially for a lot of our kids that are coming to us through adoption and foster care, that, you know, not rigidity, but having that predictability throughout the day is so important to manage their stress.
I'm Dawn Davenport. I'm the director of Creating a Family. We are the National Adoption and Infertility Education and Support Nonprofit, and you can find us online at creatingafamily.org. One of the things we do at Creating a Family is have Adopt Ed for Parents courses, and we have a number of courses that deal with sleep issues. We've interviewed experts who have varying opinions on how to deal with sleep issues, and we have courses with each of these experts. To get more information about our courses and the sleep courses in particular, you can go to our website, creatingafamily.org, click on online education, then click on for adoptive parents, and there's a sorting mechanism on the right-hand side. Type in the words sleep, and every course that deals with sleep will pop up, and you can select whatever course it is you want. And I think you will really find them very helpful. The Creating Your Family radio show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. For women who have been undergoing fertility treatment and are still struggling to conceive, there are so many daily scenarios and interactions that can take a toll on their emotional health. Ferticom is a newly released app for Apple and Android that was developed by reproductive psychologists Dr. Ali Domar and Dr. Elizabeth Grill. It was designed specifically to help women address the many challenging and emotional life situations that arise when you're struggling to conceive. They use a cognitive behavioral and relaxation techniques, and Ferticom goes through and gives you 500 different coping options, and they deal with, I think it's over 50 or maybe it is 50 specific situations that come up frequently. And you can then, they offer you solutions and things you can do to try to cope better with these situations. You can get more information at their website, ferticomapp.com. This show is also, this show as well as all the other resources provided by Creating a Family could not happen without the generous support from all of our gold sponsors who believe in our mission of providing unbiased education and support to those struggling to create a family. Two of our wonderful gold sponsors are Children's House International. They're a nonprofit, Hague-accredited international adoption agency with programs in 13 countries. They provide full services, including home studies, in the states of Florida, Louisiana, Massachusetts, Texas, Utah, and Washington State. And they place children with any U.S.-approved family worldwide. And we also have Spence Chapin. They are a licensed and accredited nonprofit organization in New York City that has been offering adoption services for more than 100 years. Their robust post-adoption services provide birth parents, adoptive parents, and adoptees a supportive community and a connection to professionals who understand the unique aspects of adoption. And we also have other great sponsors whose generosity allows us to bring you this show. We ask that when choosing an adoption service provider, please choose one from the Creating a Family directories, which you can find on the service provider page of our site. You can search by location, number of years in operation, just a host of factors that we think are important when choosing. And by using these directories, you support those who support us, and we thank you. Today, we're going to be talking about sleep issues with adopted children. Our guest today to help us understand and learn more about sleep issues are Beth Freiberg. She is a licensed clinical social worker and associate director of the Modern Family Center at Spence Chapin Services for Families and Children. We also have three other experts, moms who have helped their adopted kids through sleep issues. We have Rachel Volkel and Sarah Jacina. Welcome all of you to Creating a Family.
Thank you.
All right. I'm going to start with Rachel and Sarah, the moms, and begin with them. What I'd like to ask you each, and Sarah, I'm going to begin with you, and then Rachel, I'll come over to you. I'd like to know the type of adoption, domestic, infant, foster, or international, the age of the child or the children at adoption, and the type of sleep issues that you faced. Sarah, let's start with you.
Yes, I actually adopted two children from foster care. They were 6 and 10 at the time of adoption, and my child with sleep issues was the 6-year-old, and bedtime was just a trigger for him. Every little thing would trigger a temper tantrum, and even if we'd had a very good day, we were likely to go off the deep end as soon as the bedtime routine started.
Okay. Yeah, feel your pain there. All right, Rachel, tell us your adoptions and your sleep issues you faced.
Okay, yes, I adopted my son at, he was 8 years old at time of adoption, and it was through foster care. And it's pretty much the same as the other mother. He, even if we have, you know, a good day, bedtime is just a trigger for him. So there'll be nights where it's perfectly fine and he's able to handle it, and then there are other nights where it's just as soon as it gets to a certain point of the bedtime routine, it's like a flip switches, and he goes into rages, and sometimes it ends up getting violent, and or he'll do things to hurt himself, and it just really escalates. That's pretty much what we've been working through.
Okay, and Sarah, how old is your 6-year-old now?
10. He'll be 11 the first part of next month.
And Rachel, how old is your 8-year-old now?
He's turning 9 in a couple weeks.
Okay, gotcha. So you're relatively new into this. Okay, great. All right, we're going to come back to talking about triggers that happen at sleep. But first, Beth, can you talk to us just in general about how adoption impacts sleep? And does it depend on the type of adoption or the age of the child at adoption?
Wow, that's a great, big, broad question and a good one to start with. I think that, one thing to keep in mind is I think I read a statistic around that 30% of us, of kids and really struggle with sleep at some point. So it's important to remember that learning how to sleep is something that we all manage and go through and have to learn how to do. And there are definitely unique situations for families created through adoption, but sometimes it can be comforting to remember that it's something that a real large majority of kids and teens and even adults have to manage. So for adoptive families, one of the biggest things that we are working through is the history of the family, right? What had happened in our little ones' lives before they joined us that are informing how it feels for them to release at night, right? To be able to move into that mode in the evening time where for many of us sleep is a very frightening and scary thing for lots of different reasons. To come back to that initial part of the question, I think it is very, very unique for each child and each family. But because of the struggles that many of our kids have before they come to live with us, it really creates sort of nuanced circumstances in our family that we need to attend to.
All right. It's probably going to be no surprise to any of you, or really any in our audience, we received a lot of questions from our online community about sleep issues. And we received a number, actually quite a few, but I've selected three that all are dealing with, it feels to me, the same issue. So I'm going to read just three of them, and because they're representing slightly different, as you point out, Beth, nuances. All right, the first is from Erica. She said, how do you know when it's okay to let your adopted child learn to self-soothe through longer crying, fussing, before you go into them or comfort them? I struggle and still struggle to know when it's safe to let them self-soothe as opposed to picking them up. I guess there is a middle ground, which is what I'm always trying to find. I am so tired, though. Her children were, she has a number of them, but she has the three that she's asking about were all adopted through foster care, and they came to her in varying ages at 2 months, I think 2 months, 3 months, and 8 months when they were placed with her. Another question was from Susanna. My two kids do not sleep through the night ever. They were adopted at 2 and 2.5 from foster care. One had been with another foster family from birth, and the other was placed with us at 2 after she was removed from her family for neglect. They are now 4 and 5 and are still waking several times every night. My husband and I have not slept together for 3 years. On some level, I think I am the problem. I read everything I could find on your site on attachment and was determined that I would do everything in my power to help these girls attach. I certainly succeeded at that, but I think I may have gone overboard. I can't stand to hear them cry or for them to be unhappy, especially at night. I go to them immediately, and it drives my husband up the wall. He and I fight over it frequently. He thinks I'm spoiling them. I would love any advice any of your guests can give me. And then the last one that I'm reading is because it's a slightly different type of adoption, and she asked that I not use her name. We adopted our beautiful baby boy 10 months ago. We were at the hospital at his birth. He came home with us. He has never slept through the night and still wakes up at least 2 times every night. I think he is ready to sleep through the night, but all the adoption forums explode when I tell them I'm going to let him self-soothe. She said, paren, cry it out, in paren, help. All right, this I think was probably the number one question we certainly got for this show, but also from running a really large online support group, I see this question come up, and it's the nexus between attachment and getting a good night's sleep. And Beth, as you stated, helping our children learn, because I think that is something so darn important for us to realize that sleeping through the night is for many of us a learned event, and therefore, but I often wonder. And Beth, I'm going to start with you because I don't think this fits any of our Sarah or Rachel's specific situations. So we're terrified that we're going to screw our kids for life if we let them cry. Basically, that's it. Yeah. Bottom line. Yeah. So will we?
Right. it's we do such a number on ourselves, right? To
we
feel.
Do.
So worried ourselves and so anxious with this awesome responsibility of taking care of a child. And I think that it's one of the hardest things and one of the things that that in my practice here work really hard on is to sort of take care of the parent. You know, attend to the parent's needs also in all of this conversation to help them sort through a little bit. You know, I was taking some notes when you were talking, Dawn, but I don't remember. Oh, you didn't give a name for the second question. Sort of, are we part of the problem?
The second one is Susanna.
Yeah.
And Erica was
just
the
first,
and then the other one was not.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, just that piece of what are we contributing to this, right? What's our part in this story? What are our needs? What's getting met? What could we be? You know, we can't really get into that in depth today, except to say that piece of self-reflection and that ability to tune in and to think about really what do we want to happen, because when we're teaching, you know, our kids how to sleep, we're sort of looking at short-term goals and long-term goals, and that can be sort of a nice way of breaking it down. So one of the things that can help, especially if you're in a couple, is to think together about what are our long-term goals as a family. And to remember, and if your long-term goal is for the child to ultimately sleep independently, or maybe your long-term goal is, you know, I'm okay with the child sleeping in our bedroom, you know, or on the cot next to the bed. So a piece of that initial work I find can be very helpful is to try to see if families can sort of define for themselves what are their values as a couple, as an individual, if they're parenting on their own. Because I think that most folks would agree that the first piece of when you're parenting is to make sure that that attachment comes first, right? So you really want to be working towards creating that safety, that security, that continuous reassurance for a child when they're first coming into your home. And that really needs to come first before you're sort of moving into dealing with sleep issues. Should I pause or should I go on?
Well, pause for a second. One of the things I have seen, this is a while back, a couple of years ago, I did a very informal survey of families who were co-sleeping. And we're going to talk about co-sleeping a little later. But this relates directly to your point about identifying, and I like that thought about identifying your long-term goals. What I found, and I found it a lot when I interviewed people, and I do mean a lot, is that the wife would often say, oh, we are fine with co-sleeping. And then I would find out that co-sleeping very often meant the mother and the children sleeping in the parents' bed and the father sleeping on the couch or one of the kids' beds. I was surprised by that. I had not, that was, and I have no idea how common this is. But it came up very frequently that co-sleeping actually wasn't family sleeping, or wasn't a family bed, it was a mom and kid bed, and that I didn't actually interview a couple of times I interviewed the dad, and he really wasn't okay with it. But so what do you do when one of your values is, I don't want to hear him cry, and the other value is, I want them to sleep either. Let's don't even get into their own bed. I just want them to sleep through the night, you know, which, so let's just stick with that one now.
What's the value that we've defined?
Well, we have
the value
we have
is
a competing one. I don't want them to cry. I don't want to risk the attachment that we've worked on. And I don't want them to cry. I don't want to feel like a bad mother. Versus, I also would like for them to, I would like them to sleep through the night so that I could. So I have two competing values.
So I think that one of the first things to look at is to do sort of a little bit of an inventory to decide whether or not you feel that your child has been in your home long enough and that the relationship that you've built is indeed secure. So if the child, and that there really isn't, I don't think there's really a formula for that. I wish there was. You know, you could say, you know, if your child's been home for 6 months or 1 year or 2 years, because as we were saying before, you know, each child and each family dynamic is going to be unique. But if you've moved past that initial phase of what's sometimes referred to as sort of that immediate, you know, sort of dependency bond, right, that sort of those initial phases, and you've really been living together and you feel that your child has developed trust and that there is a strong attachment formed, you know, I think that that first step is that the parent really needs to believe that and to understand, if that's true, that their child could tolerate sort of a weaning off process. And what we're trying to do in that situation is to create a different kind of association for the child so that the child begins to have a positive association with sleep that is not only about having the parent being the person who's soothing them, right? So if you believe in your heart, or you can fake it a little bit if you believe it most of the way, but it's still breaking your heart, that the child, that this child is, you know, right, like during the day they're doing well, they're firmly attached, they're able to really get soothed by me at all other times, then you really could begin to wean yourself off of being that primary person, that association for your child. And maybe we'll, you know, I don't know if now is the time to get into how to do that or not. But I think that most folks would agree that at a certain point, some kind of controlled crying, you know, can, you know, be successful, but only after that attachment has been established and after that safety is in place. I'm curious what your other guests would think about that.
Well, I was going to ask if either Sarah or Rachel, and we'll start with Rachel this time. Did you experience a problem with you? The problem that both of you mentioned was tantrums and raging at bedtime. Did you also experience the problem of a child, or both of you, I think there were both sons in your cases, when your sons got to sleep, where they woke up constantly throughout the night or frequently throughout the night? Rachel? Oops, hang on just a second. I apologize. I apologize, Rachel. Say that again, Rachel.
Okay.
I had you muted because you had some background noise going on. So, yeah, did you experience that with your son?
Mostly he sleeps through the night. Once the biggest issue is just getting him to a restful place to actually fall asleep. But once he's asleep, sometimes there'd be he would wake up one or two times. But he's very quick to go back to sleep once he's past that. But the biggest issue for us is just that initial getting his body to a restful place where he can sleep.
And Sarah, your son, does he sleep through the night once you finally get him to sleep?
He has started doing it more in the last couple of years, but no. He wakes up several times in the night.
And how have you held? How have you handled the waking up at night issues? And was it a struggle for you that tension you felt, or did you feel a tension between creating attachment and getting a good night's sleep?
I was less worried about creating attachment that really at that point than I was about safety, because he wouldn't just wake up; he would wake up and wander.
Yeah,
and so. It was important to me that he wasn't getting into things that he shouldn't be getting into. He was, of course, emotionally young for his age and had some serious impulse control issues and what have you at the time. In the beginning, we would get up, we would soothe him, we would put him back to bed. But really what ultimately started happening there was that nobody was sleeping. And so we were tired and we were cranky. And we weren't able to deal with his emotional needs during the day. And he was tired and he was cranky and he was having a lot of emotional needs during the day. And so we just kind of gave up on the idea of self-soothing back to sleep at that point, because he was emotionally too young, even if he was physically old enough. And I brought him, my husband traveled for work, and I started bringing him to bed with me if he woke up in the middle of the night, because my alternative was up every 30 to 40 minutes. And I couldn't function as a single parent with my husband on the road with him waking up like that. And he would sleep and I would sleep and we would be able to have a good day. And then the older that he got, he stopped waking up as much. But if he would wake up, he still comes and gets into bed with us. He will go to bed in his own bed now, and about 50% of the time he will come climb into our bed at night. And now that he is almost 11, he's getting a little large for that. His feet are bigger than mine. but it's becoming less and less of a need for him to do so. And so I think that he is more comfortable and less anxious. And once we could address that anxiousness, the need to get up helped more. We also firmly believe in medication if necessary. And so he is on some anxiety medicine for some other issues, and this helps make him sleepy. And we had to move from regular melatonin to ER melatonin because he was getting to sleep very easily but not staying there. And since we moved to the ER melatonin, that has helped quite a bit as well.
Okay, excellent. Is that a prescription, by the way?
Melatonin, no, that's over-the-counter.
The ER,
the anxiety medicine, yes, is a prescription.
The extended release, is it over-the-counter as well?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, excellent. All right. Beth, when you first bring a child home, be it an infant through domestic infant adoption or an older child through either international or foster care adoption, you said that first our focus needs to be on attachment. So how does that look at night? We heard from Sarah that for her, it looked bringing the child into the bed with her. What are some other options? So that's one option, is to have the child sleep with you you or your you by yourself or you and your partner. So that's one option. What are some other options that can through the night to options to maintain attachment if you don't want the child sleeping with you?
One of the phrases that I've heard used that I really liked was, is the goal of being as emotionally and physically present as you need to be, but with sort of the least bit or the minimal amount of like actual contact or intervention. So keeping in mind that you want to continuously be responsive to your child, right? Because what you're working on at those early stages is letting them know that you are there for, right? You are there. You are that safe home base for them. But trying to do that in the way that has the least, I can't quite find that right word, but what's the word? Like the least amount that you need to do while at the same time making sure that you're consistently being there, which sounds a little like it's contradictory. But that
it's not,
might
though. I don't think it is.
Right? Do you
I
understand?
I hear exactly what you're saying. Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I used the word nexus earlier, so I almost hated to use it again because it seems like it would be a little bit overused. But it is, you want to be as present as you need to be, but no more so.
But there we go, with no more so. So let's say a child is waking up in the night, but you're in, you know, your gut might tell you that you want to go and lie down with them, but maybe actually you can show them that you're there and help them feel secure and safe by not lying down with them, but maybe by coming in and checking on them and standing in the doorway, right? I'm here, you know, you're safe, I'm going to be sleeping in the other room, you know, and continuously showing up for them, but doing it, again, in that, you know, in the least way possible. What we want to be doing is making sure that we're always showing up for them, but not so much necessarily, if you don't want to, bringing that child into your bed or making sure that, you know, they're holding your hand while they're sleeping, or maybe that maybe you're starting off with the fact that they need a lot of contact and they need to be held and need to be rocked. And then when your audience is probably very familiar with this, but then you sort of begin to wean yourself away from that, right? So then you're moving yourself from, you know, maybe if you're in the bed with them to you being on the floor, to you being in the hallway, to you being back in your room, or any kind of very small incremental shifts where that child then learns that they can count on you to be there, but not necessarily be physically in contact with them, so they learn how to fall asleep without you physically being there.
And another example of the weaning you just described would be the reverse, where the child, and I experienced this with one of mine, coming, we had decided it was time, we did not want to be sharing a bed, so we made a pallet for him on the floor, nothing fancy, just a pallet, just some blankets. And he went to bed in his own bed, but then he would come, and then on his own, interestingly enough, although we started the process, we started moving the pallet closer and closer to our door, and then he took over. He was responsible for setting up his own pallet, and he would come down with his, and he gradually started moving it to the hallway, and then gradually down the hallway, and you know, until he was fairly old, probably 13 or so, before he no longer came down and slept on the floor. He was upstairs; his bedroom's upstairs. So anyway, so that's another way to wean it, is the reverse. If the child has been coming to you,
sometimes what people like to do is sort of make it comfortable, but not that inviting. Right?
Exactly.
So like you're saying, it's not like the most fabulous cozy bed, but it's totally, but you're looking at safety, of course, you know, and making sure that it's a safe place. And then some kids will take ownership over that, like it sounds like your child did, and sort of move themselves out. And some kids will really need a lot more encouragement from parents. And if the child is, you know, able to cognitively, those are great conversations that we can have with our kids. You know, sort of you can be talking about it, and some kids really benefit from having that incentivized in some way, and families have different values around that, but sometimes kids can earn stickers, or you have a challenge prize box, or, you know, some way to make it so that they get some positive reinforcement after managing something that's difficult for them. And again, that really, a lot of, you know, families have, you know, different ideas about whether or not they want to, how they want to do that.
Whether or not that is something that they, that they're wanting to do or whatever. The one thing I would suggest with melatonin is, and I'm coming back to Sarah's suggestion, I would strongly suggest, and I'm sure, Sarah, you did this, but you discuss this with your pediatrician, before you introduce melatonin, and obviously, of course, any other medications, but he would have to. But even something over the counter, I think it's important that you discuss with your doctor, your child's doctor, first. All right. Now, we've got a question, no name. This is a domestic adoption at birth. She says, my 12, almost 13-year-old, off and on, wants me to stay with him until he falls asleep. I figure this will stop naturally when he's ready, but feel guilty that I'm doing it as if I shouldn't be. Any thoughts on conversations with myself in my head or with him? So this mom doesn't know if she's feeling guilty because she's doing it. Any thoughts on that, Beth?
She doesn't know whether she herself feels guilty.
No, she says she does feel guilty.
She does feel guilty.
When he asks her to stay with him until he falls asleep, she does this, but she is feeling guilty when she does this.
Because she feels at this stage it could be something that he could stop needing.
She didn't say, but my guess is I'm trying to put myself, I'm imagining myself in that situation. I would be, and I'm speaking for myself, not her at this point. I would be worried that I'm enabling, that I'm not encouraging him to separate in a healthy way from me, and that I'm encouraging him to be dependent upon me to fall asleep. That's what I would be worrying about.
So one thing that comes to mind is that for a child that age, if he's able, and I will just assume that he is it's an uncomfortable conversation, but one that she could probably try to have with him, you know, which is to say, I love being with you close at night. You know, it feels, you know, there's many things that are really nice about being with you at this time of night, but I'm thinking that maybe now that you're, you know, at this age, you know, we may want to put some other, you know, techniques in place so that if I'm not here for you at night, or if you want to sleep over at a friend's house or go to camp, that you have ways for yourself that you can release and feel comfortable going to sleep. And then you can brainstorm, right? With a teenager, you could say, you know, let's come up with some ideas together about other things that we can do, and let's give them a try. So that could look like, right, maybe having, you know, I don't think we're ever too old to have transitional objects. Right, I think adults still use them. Right, we want to have something that helps us feel safe and secure, that maybe reminds us of a person that helped us feel that way. So some kids have found that, you know, having photographs in the room of the parent, right, or maybe having an object of mom. Like, we think about that more for when we're transitioning toddlers, right, that we have a smelly something that smells like our parent, right. But, you know, I think you could be very creative and find things that could help him begin to learn how to release on his own and let go and fall asleep. And I would also sort of look a little bit more closely around what's happening for him at night so that he's wanting mom to be there. Should I pause or should I give some examples?
No, go ahead and give some examples. I'm sitting here thinking of the transitional objects. I was thinking of that. No, please, give some examples.
Of like a transitional object or things, right? Because even though he's a teenager, you know, if he's needing her there, there's still a piece of him that needs that attachment or wants that security. So maybe, you know, she could talk to him. And for kids that have some anxiety or for some stress, one of the things that can be really helpful is just to try to identify what the fears are. You know, what are you, you know, if he can talk about that, right? So there are all kinds of fears that we have. And this probably relates a little bit more to younger kids. Right, but some kids, and I'd be curious to know what other folks have experienced for their kids, but sometimes kids will just fear actually that they can't fall asleep. That's a pretty common fear, right? They don't know how to fall asleep, and they're scared that they can't do it. They're actually afraid of not being able to sleep. Lots of adults have that problem too, right? Lots of kids are worried. Exactly, right? You're up, you can't fall asleep. A lot of kids at night just are afraid, like their minds start racing if kids who have fears or have higher levels of anxiety, right? And it isn't one particular thing. It's more like just what we would think of as adults is sort of more like a globalized or generalized anxiety. And we don't know how to turn off our mind. We just don't know how to relax. And so for those kids, we would really work with them, and many of us can connect with that, about how to let go at night, right? So that can look like progressive relaxation techniques or mindfulness or meditation or, you know, lots of us will listen to tapes to help let go of the day. Sometimes kids really are afraid of dying at night, they associate that, you know, experience of letting go, of losing control. And we need to help them with that. And lots of us are also just afraid of sort of bad guys and monsters and scary things that sort of creep up in the evening. So helping the kids to identify those things and talking about them and providing some reassurance or techniques to work through something like that and desensitization during the day. We work on it during the day. Those are just some examples of the types of categories that fears fall into.
All right. Now I want to circle back to the problem that Sarah and Rachel both identified with their sons, and that is children. And this is not an uncommon problem. Again, I think it's far more common in my experience with adopted kids than not. But tantrums just triggers. I think both Sarah and Rachel, you both use the word trigger. There is something at bedtime that is triggering your child. Let me start with Sarah. Because since you've been at this for a longer period of time, 4 years or thereabouts, so were you ever able to identify what it was? Was it something in your son's history? What was it that was about bedtime that triggered him?
My son is one of those that's a constant mover. I don't know that he is capable of being still. And I think, and we thought at the time, that bedtime was just when he stopped and thought. And when he stopped and thought, he had anxiety. And so bedtime was always a trigger because we were intentionally making him stop. But you couldn't do distraction things at bedtime because those would wind him back up, and this was opposite of the point of him getting ready to go to bed. And oftentimes he would just get angry. And he has only here in the last couple of years really been able to identify the cause and effect of emotions, that, you know, I am feeling X emotion because Y thing happened. And at the time he just knew he was scared and he was going to do anything and everything to not have whatever it was that was scaring him scare him.
Okay, Rachel, have you been able to find out the trigger for your little fella?
Yes. Actually, I've had him since he was six, and he had been in his birth family up until he was five. So even though he was adopted at eight, he's been with me for about 3 years. And very early on, it started to be kind of obvious what the problem was. The rages didn't start too early, but he had to have me stay with him in the room. And he finally said it one night, he said, "Mama, can you keep your eyes open so I can close mine?" And he just was so scared all the time. And he would keep his eyes on the door the whole night. And then finally he started to trust that, yes, I'll keep my eyes open. You just go to sleep. I'm right here. So it slowly started to come out, and, you know, over the years, especially as he's gotten older, and especially since the adoption, I think, just the safety of knowing that he's, you know, he's here and it's forever. He's been able to verbalize a lot more of, you know, his history and different things about nighttime. And, so it's just a time where his adrenaline just shoots through the roof because that's just the time he has to be, you know, on the lookout.
Yeah.
So it's a very quick trigger where sometimes he can sleep because even though the adrenaline's high, not much else is happening, but it's just, you know, hairline trigger at that point where if he's already so, you know, his nerves are like on the outside of his body at night. So when something does hit, it just goes from 0 to 100 pretty quick. But I've noticed that they do end when he's been able to say the actual thing that's looping in his mind or the memory or verbalizing it, and then the anger shifts from me over to the situation and then it's done. And then he's like, "Okay, I can go to sleep now." And I'm like, "Okay." But so,
and you're like, "I won't be able to, but you go."
I know, I'm like, "I just got a workout for 5 hours, but all right."
But that's is Beth. I just wanted to say, I think that's such a beautiful illustration, though, about how we can hold our kids' fears for them. You know, mommy, will you mm-hmm. open, you know, you keep your eyes open so I can close mine. I don't know, that really just touched me as a way of him being yeah. able to, you know, share with you where his fear is, you know, give it mm-hmm. over to you because he trusts you, right?
Yeah.
And I think that so many parents could connect to that if they can create that space for their child to let them know what they're so afraid of because of that incredible vigilance that so many kids have needed to have, especially at nighttime,
mm-hmm.
you know, which could is so often a scary time for kids who have been living in foster care or, you know, have been in, you know, living in orphanages or times where they're, like you're saying, their stress hormones are so high. And they've learned that's so adaptive, right? That's such an adaptive
mm-hmm.
way that so many kids have developed that they have to unlearn that.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be able to have that empathy and understand that, I think a lot of parents, you know, when you aren't around, when you don't have the opportunity to know what's happening, can feel manipulated and get so angry because we're exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not
exactly.
creative.
Yeah.
We're not patient. You know, we're burned out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and like that last caller that had, or not the last caller, the last mm-hmm. question that you had asked about, because I used to go through that work because he would need me to stay in his room with him, and I was just like, this is like 2 hours that I need to just go breathe, like I'm so exhausted,
mm-hmm.
and I don't want to lay here in the dark and just like wait, and it was very exhausting, and so sometimes I would leave, but then I just kept getting this feeling like he needs something, like he needs me in there for some reason, you know, and then it was a couple months after that he had said that to me, and I was like, you know, that's just where he is, where, you know, he needs somebody to, he just needs, like you said, to place that trust in somebody, that someone's going to watch out for him, and then he can sleep, and even though we're still, you know, having night problems and stuff, but there's certain levels of it that have gotten better since then. So it's just, for me, it was worth it to stay in there with him because it has developed a lot of that trust and attachment because he knows I'm going to, you know, be watching out for him. And so.
Rachel, have you used any of the weaning techniques? Are you still in there most nights for 2 hours while he falls asleep? Or was there something that you did that allowed you to wean off or allowed him to wean off of your presence when he's going to sleep?
You know, it's gone back and forth because I originally, a couple years ago, we were able to where I, you know, I would assure him that I'm sitting right outside your door. I'm right by the front door. I'm still watching out for you. And so I would, you know, slowly transition out of the room and I would play audiobooks in his room so that he could keep his mind on something and not just let it go crazy because that's when it would fall apart. So that worked for a bit. And then again, after the adoption, you know, I would like to think everything suddenly got better after he was adopted, but that was the point where a lot more came out. So we kind of regressed a bit in a way, where now he needs me again because he's, you know, more of these things he's able to process and he's able to suddenly think about where before he was more, you know, he was kind of too young and was pushing it away. So now we're back to him needing me in there with him. So it's kind of just another phase in his development that we're trying to figure out. But in the past, that had worked, just reassuring him, you know, that I was out there and giving him something else to focus on.
Dawn, I wanted to tell you one other technique, if I could.
Yeah, please. Mm-hmm.
So one thing that I had has been helpful for some families that reminded me of something you were saying before is that sometimes kids who especially are very active, but really the only time that they begin to – that they have experience quieting their mind and, like you were saying, like sort of the fears of the day sort of bubble up is at night. So something that can help is to try to find other times during the day so that the child has experience with being relaxed and so it doesn't all happen, it doesn't build up all through the day and just come out at night, which is harder because older kids don't necessarily have a nap time or have kind of quiet time. But I thought that was an interesting thing to think about, of building in other times of you know, of reflection or quiet time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can definitely see how that would work because it allows them a time some time to have those thoughts other than at bedtime.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah, I wanted to swing back to you. What have you found with your son? Now, you've mentioned medication has helped. What else has helped with your son as far as the tantruming at bedtime?
In the beginning, we had to, we ended up having to do therapeutic holding at bedtime because he literally had to wear himself out. Mm. That was no fun for anybody, but I did get an upper body workout most evenings. But that wasn't any fun. I mean, it wasn't any fun for him. It wasn't any fun for us. And it also wasn't helping with the bonding piece. We moved to reading stories at bedtime. And if he could relax enough to listen to the story and fall asleep during the story, then that worked okay. But sometimes he could and sometimes he couldn't. And then when he got to an age where he really could read to himself and wanted to, we couldn't let him do it at bedtime because he would get distracted and start doing other things that weren't reading. And so literally right now, we go through our bedtime routine. He lays down in our bed for some nights literally as little as 30 seconds until he falls asleep. And then we wake him up, we walk him to his own bed. He curls up in his bed, says goodnight, rolls over, and goes right back out. So it was just where he went to bed that changed everything.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's an interesting one where you can let him fall asleep one place and then move him back. Okay, that's one. And, you know, I would just say that even once our kids are able to read to themselves, I still think it's important and fun to continue to read to them, even, you know, having chapter books that you're reading with your
mm-hmm.
children.
Oh, absolutely. My husband
yeah.
and son went all the way through all of the Harry Potter.
yeah. We did as well.
Several other series, but he wanted to read to himself.
Sure, yeah,
it,
exactly.
Being read
yeah.
to was no longer relaxing to him, so that's why that stopped.
Right, yeah. Well, and then as Beth has said at the beginning, each child is unique, and we have to
mm-hmm.
Have to accept that. Here's a question. We got two of these, which is interesting to me. It kind of surprised me. I didn't think of this as an issue. I'll just read one. It's from Amy. How long is it acceptable for a 13-year-old to sleep with the lights on? And we got a separate one, a child wanting to sleep with the lights on. With Amy's, her child is newly placed. Her question was, how long is it okay for him to sleep with his lights on after placement? He had
mm-hmm.
visited four times prior but didn't sleep with the lights on. And then the other person was just asking, in general, a child that wants to sleep with the lights on, should you let them? That's an interesting one. I hadn't really thought. I was surprised we got two with that. Beth, thoughts on the light
mm-hmm.
being left on, and I assume neither of these is night lights. I think they're bigger
yeah.
lights. Okay.
Yeah. My initial response is, especially for a child who's newly joined your family, you know, you do what works. You know that you know it sort of falls in that category a little bit of sort of good sleep hygiene, and good sleep hygiene typically talks about, you know, dim room, right, and keeping the light consistent with sort of the daylight flow, you know, so your circadian rhythm gets set. But
mm-hmm.
I also really do believe that, you know, it's clearly helping with some kind of fear or distress or anxiety, right, which you could work towards once you build trust. And as we've been talking about, you know, as your child begins to feel comfortable sharing with you what they're worried about and what their fears are. But if a child can sleep and the light is on, if it's okay with everybody else, I don't see why there would be a problem with it if the child is getting a good night's sleep.
Well, I also would think it's something that you could once the child has been and you've established that you feel like the child is secure, I also think it's something that you could wean them off of, from the overhead to a lamp, and then from the lamp reducing the wattage of the bulb, with the ultimate goal is to get to a nightlight. And so that's something that it just because they're sleeping with a, and then once they're secure, I do think it's healthy to try to. Seems to me to try to wean them.
Just sort of wind that down. But in the beginning, if it's helping them to feel safe, right? And I also kind of think around the idea that you want to sort of pick the things that you're working on, right? So if you have bigger things that you're working on and you need to make, you know, you want to just leave that light on so that you can focus on other things in your family. But if that's the one thing that, you know, you feel like you're ready to work on and you want to start weaning that off, then I, you know, I'm with you on that, Dawn. Then you sort of start dimming the lights. But I don't see it initially as a big problem. But it's probably letting you know that there's something that the child is very anxious about that you want to start to work to understand.
Yeah, I like that. Use that as it's a symptom. Don't worry about it.
It's information. It's sort of telling you that there's something else going on. And a lot of times if we put a lot of attention, kids can feel embarrassed and they can feel shame. But it's telling you, you know, it's a little bit like kids would have any other kind of repetitive behaviors or how kids may rock. Right? It's letting you know, depending on the reasons for the rocking, but if it's around anxiety or how the child's dealing with stress or boredom, it's sort of letting you know that you need to attend to something, right? Because it's a symptom. They're showing you, that behavior is showing you something.
And use it as information. Yeah. Also, this is almost the reverse issue that Rachel had. And we got two questions on this as well. One, and again, this one is from Amy, is it unusual for a child not to be able to go to sleep until other siblings go to bed? And that's her child is newly adopted. And then we've got another question from Robert asking, is it, it's long, but anyway, his child can't go to sleep until everyone in the house is in bed. So that's, again, surprised me. We got two questions on this. Beth, thoughts on that? The sibling one, my first thought was that was, you know, they get to stay up later than me. There's something fun going on, but it may be more complex than that. And certainly the one about wanting to be up until everybody goes to bed. Thoughts on that, Beth?
I was where you went, Dawn, with initially for kids, right, when the house is active, right? It can mean, I mean, two big broad categories. One, where you were going initially, which was like, wow, there's great stuff going on, and I don't want to miss out, right? I'm learning this family. I'm learning the routine, I want to be part of it. And then the other side, which would make us, you know, would bring us to be looking a little bit more about the child's background, right? So much of what we're doing in all of this is looking at the child's history and trying to explore what we know happened for that child at nighttime and where there might be something where the child would feel vulnerable or feel scared because either things happened at night when people were awake and like we were referring to before, they're so vigilant that they can't let go until the house is quiet. Maybe someone came in, you know, into their room at night. We can think of lots of examples. I know we were sort of winding down in terms of time, right? But like lots of examples of things that could be happening in a child's environment where they may have also been responsible at night. Maybe they were in a caretaking situation in a previous living situation, you know, where they were parentified and they have learned never to fall asleep until everybody else is safe. So I think it would be about looking back into their story and seeing what was happening for them at night and finding ways either with the parents or maybe with some help of a counselor or other people that the child trusts to begin to help them to tell us the story of what happened to them and then to reassure them in any way possible so that they could feel that they don't have to be the one who has to, you know, either be so vigilant or to protect.
And Sarah, were there things were you able in retrospect to identify things in your son's history that have contributed to the issues at bedtime? Or for him, do you feel it's more just his activity level, his energy?
I don't think there was any trigger that was specifically bedtime related. There was nothing in his history that implied that ought to be something to be concerned about. I think that honestly it was just the time of day that his body settled and he had the time to stop and think about all of the other things that scared him.
Mm-hmm. And he has anxiety anyway, so that, yeah.
Yes,
and
he has significant anxiety.
Rachel, what about you? Were you able to define things in your son's history? Not, you don't have to give us the specific information, but the was some of your son's struggles the history surrounding bedtime before he came to you?
Yes, yeah, his is definitely part of his history. And then also he does have an extreme amount of energy, so I think it's part of what Sarah's saying too. But, yeah, and like I said, like over time, different pieces come out because a lot of what his therapist has been working with him on is being able to feel in his body when the rage is about to start. And, you know, he describes it as firecrackers. So we're like, okay, we got to catch it when it's one firecracker or two. So, you know, we've been basically, I ask him almost every hour, like, where is your firecracker level at? And through that, we've been able to kind of find some things, like that even brushing his teeth is apparently bumps up the firecrackers in him. And so, you know, we had to change that routine a bit. And so there's just like a lot of layers, but most of it is definitely with his history. So it's just kind of managing that throughout the day so that it doesn't explode at night. But yeah.
But giving him, what I hear you also saying is that you're giving him the ability, you're teaching him to recognize the firecracker level inside of him. And ultimately, mm-hmm. I assume the goal will be for him to be able to not only identify, but then take steps, you know, when he is older to start controlling the number of firecrackers. What a great analogy. Excellent.
Yeah, and he's been able to slowly. I've seen just even in the past couple of months where he starts to feel and he'll say, I'm feeling it. And then, you know, he'll take his deep breaths and he'll do all the million coping skills that we have. And he'll be able to not go into a rage. And it's just amazing to see him working at that. And but it takes a lot of time for sure. So.
Yeah, and a lot of energy and effort on his part and your part, both.
Yes, yes.
One of the moms who is going to be on the panel and was not able to get off from work is Jen. And she adopted her daughter from Korea and is actually heading back over there now to pick up another son this time. And I think her daughter was two. And her daughter was very used, had been sleeping with foster parents, which is a cultural thing that happens very frequently in Korea and other countries as well. So let's talk a little about, and Beth, I'm asking you this question, helping children transition from one sleeping pattern that they have prior to adoption to what fits better with your family's long-term goals for sleep.
So one thing to keep in mind is keeping as many things consistent, right, for the kids as possible, right, because they've gone through such a tremendous transition. So learning as much as you can from the orphanage or foster family who's been taking care of your child about what their routine has been, you know, what things you can keep in place are going to be so important. And then I think going back to looking at what your long-term goals are, knowing that those short-term goals are going to be about creating trust and attachment, and thinking that if this is, if you as a, because it's Korea, we can assume it's a couple, you know, if you're a couple and in the long term you really are comfortable having a child in your bed, then a family may make the decision that they're going to continue to sleep, you know, have the child in their room similarly to how the child was used to sleeping in the foster family. But if you know that the long term really is not to have a child in your bed, and you feel very strongly about that, then perhaps the way to manage that weaning process, right, we sort of talked about it going both ways, would be to start off the child in, you know, in his or her bedroom, right, with, again, things as, you know, very, very decluttering the bedroom, right, starting off with some really positive sleep hygiene, right, so, you know, picking three or four things that you do, you know, three or four rituals that you stick to them each night, and that you begin to maybe, if she won't fall asleep without you being sleeping next to her, you know, follow that a little bit of that routine that we talked about before, you know, sort of slowly weaning yourself out of her room.
I'm sorry, go ahead. No, I was just summing up what you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is to set up, maintain as much consistency as possible, and
mm-hmm.
then set up a routine which you follow
mm-hmm.
every night, and then depending
mm-hmm.
on what your long-term family goals are, to
mm-hmm.
just gradually start moving towards them.
Right, exactly.
Excellent.
And a lot of people like to think of good sleep, like a good night's sleep, you know, starts with a good day. And the things that you're going to be doing that we've all been talking about sort of during that day to help your child get ready for, I've heard it it explained as sort of like landing a jumbo jet, right? That you're not going to do that abruptly, right? It needs some time, some leading up. So that's why we have these, you know, very predictable, especially for a lot of our kids that are coming to us through adoption and foster care, that, you know, not rigidity, but having that predictability throughout the day is so important to manage their stress. And if we can do that well during the day, there's no promises, but it's likely to lead. You know, it can lead to a more relaxed and predictable bedtime. And another thing that's very helpful.
I found with some of my children that I have not thought of the analogy of landing a jumbo jet, but by
mm-hmm.
golly, that's spot on. I found that the bedtime routine, not for all of my kids, but for
mm-hmm.
some, needed to be much. I had to back up. It wasn't just the, you know, brush your teeth, have a glass of water, two books,
mm-hmm.
a rub in the back, saying our prayers, and going to bed. But I had to really back it up into a couple of hours before, calmer activities.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Dinner at a certain time, you know, helping clean up afterwards. I mean, it had to be, and at least for one of mine, it had to be fairly rigid. And, I mean, rigid is probably not the right word, but it had to be very,
mm-hmm.
very predictable. And and if we skipped some of that, and of course she outgrew this, but particularly when she was younger, it had to be, that was a long runway for that jumbo jet, it felt like.
Yeah, right, because you're anticipating, if you think about when you're on the airplane, if you're nervous about a landing, right, you look for all of those markers, all of those rituals to help you anticipate and that predictability. You know how things are going to end. And that's what we want for our kids, is to begin to know that all these things, I know what's going to happen, I can anticipate this. So that that stress, instead of building, you know, that natural inclination to build is starting to release and starting to let go.
You know, and I think the last thing I want to end on is the feeling that, and Sarah and Rachel both alluded to this. We have to deal with our own issues, as I think Rachel was saying. Oh my gosh, I don't want to lay here for 2 hours in the dark, you know, when I could be doing something. And I so understand that. So let me end by talking with both Rachel and Sarah on how you've dealt with some of that self-talk that gets you in the place where you, and I know you're not spending the 2 hours necessarily with them now, but because it is, the evenings, you know, are also your time to unwind. So how do you handle that, Rachel?
Where at first it was harder. The self-talk did get easier the more that I understood and the more I tried to put myself, you know, in his position and just thinking he can't handle it by himself right now. And just thinking of my personal and my family goal is just connection with him and to be able to have that. So anytime I would just be like, I would rather be sitting on the couch eating ice cream. You know, I just think, okay, well, what's my goal? Is it eating ice cream, or is it making sure that he feels safe and connecting with him? And so it's just been just kind of re-reminding myself what my bigger goal is, and just not, you know, trying to be too hard on myself when I do even have those thoughts that I'd rather be, you know, out doing something, because that's normal. But, yeah, so it's just keeping in mind, you know, what my biggest goal is, really.
Sarah, I'll give you the last word. Thoughts on how to manage your, not putting words in your mouth, but if what I would perceive, if I were there, frustration of having your time used up at night. How have you dealt with that feeling?
We stepped back and looked at really micro goals. What was the goal for right now? And the first goal really had to be everybody needed to sleep, because if we hadn't had sleep, we didn't have the emotional energy to deal with all of the rest of the things that we were dealing with. And so things like not co-sleeping, or him being able to settle himself to sleep, or any of that stuff, while it's very important in the absolute long run, we're just not that far down the goal list yet. And so we had to step back and figure out, you know, what was it going to take to get sleep? And then next, once we have got over the whatever that hurdle is, then we can think about what it's going to take to get sleep by ourselves, or sleep in our own bed, or whatever that next step is. And so the actual moving of the routine to allowing him to fall asleep in our bed, because it has shortened the routine so dramatically, has really been what has helped us cope.
Yeah, that makes sense. I like that thought of focusing. What your ultimate goal at the beginning is just how can we all get a decent night's sleep, and then we'll work backwards from there. But yeah, you're right. When you're not sleeping, it's not good for anybody. Well, thank you so very much, all of you, Beth Freiberg with Spence Chapin, with Rachel Vocal and Sarah Jacina, for being our guest today on the Creating a Family show. I really appreciate that. For our guests, for our audience, let me remind you that the information presented today is not specific to you. To apply it to your specific situation, you need to be, it's just general, so you need to talk with your professional, whomever that is, on how to apply it to your family in your specific situation. For those who would like to get more information about Beth Freiberg or the Modern Family Center with Spence Chapin, you can go to their website, Spence-Chapin, Chapin.org, and from there you can get you can click on to the Modern Family Center and get more information with them. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I will see you next week.
The Starlight Lounge presents An Evening with the Progressive Box.
Old moon, yeah. That's Hugo, tickling the ivories. He just saved by bundling home and auto with Progressive. Gonna finally buy a ring for that gal of yours, Hugo? Send her my condolences. Hi-oh! This next one's for you, too. There's a burglar in my heart. Thank you.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Let's say you just bought a house. Bad news is, you're one step closer to becoming your parents. You'll proudly mow the lawn, ask if anybody noticed you mowed the lawn, tell people to stay off the lawn, compare it to your neighbor's lawn, and complain about having to mow the lawn again. Good news is, it's easy to bundle home and auto through Progressive and save on your car insurance, which, of course, will go right into the lawn. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discount not available in all states or situations.